The silence of a Georgetown night shatters as an international assassin named Kamel methodically executes two Supreme Court justices, the liberal Rosenberg and the younger Jensen, in separate, perfectly orchestrated hits. Within hours, the nation reels in shock, while the president and his manipulative chief of staff, Fletcher Cole, see political opportunity. It's perfect. We didn't create it. It's not our fault. Their primary concern isn't justice, but the chance to reshape the court with new appointments. Meanwhile, at Tulane Law School, brilliant third-year student Darby Shaw watches the news unfold beside her lover, alcoholic constitutional law professor Thomas Callahan. Where others see tragedy, Darby's legal mind spots patterns. Someone or some group wants a different court with an absolute conservative majority, she theorizes. The election is next year. Why take a chance? Kill them now. This observation sparks her curiosity, sending her deep into the law library while Callahan drowns his sorrows in scotch. What begins as an academic exercise soon produces a 13-page document that will become infamous as the Pelican Brief, a theory so compelling it will shake Washington to its core and put a target on Darby's back. After extensive research, Darby links the assassinations to Victor Matisse, a reclusive oil tycoon who discovered a major reserve in Louisiana. His plans for a massive canal were blocked by environmentalists protecting the endangered Louisiana brown pelican. With billions at stake in a pending Supreme Court decision, Matisse had compelling motives to eliminate justices who might rule against him. When Callahan shares the brief with his friend Gavin Verheek, special counsel to the FBI director, it triggers a chain reaction through the FBI hierarchy to Director Voiles and the White House. The theoretical exercise turns deadly when Callahan's Porsche explodes after a night of drinking, killing him instantly and nearly taking Darby with it. Suddenly, the brief is no longer academic, it's prophetic. With her lover dead and killers in pursuit, Darby realizes her meticulous legal analysis has become a death warrant. Her brilliant mind that connected the dots must now keep her alive as she transforms from law student to fugitive. With cropped, dyed hair and cash instead of credit cards, Darby becomes a ghost in New Orleans, constantly changing hotels and watching shadows. Meanwhile, assassin Kamel arrives to eliminate the brief's author with the same precision he used on the justices. Kamel murders FBI agent Verheek and impersonates him to trap Darby. At their Riverwalk meeting, the disguised Kamel nearly succeeds until a mysterious gunman shoots him dead. Escaping the chaos, Darby realizes the dying man spoke Egyptian, not English. This reveals the CIA has been monitoring the situation and intervened. Victor Matisse had sold part of his oil project to Libya, bringing international intelligence into play. Darby finds herself trapped in a web where she can trust no one, not the FBI, government, or supposed protectors. Every shadow could hide an assassin. Every friendly face might conceal deadly intent. Her only hope lies in finding someone who values truth over power and has both the courage and platform to expose the conspiracy before Matisse's killers find her. Washington Post reporter Gray Grantham receives two mysterious calls, first from Garcia, hinting at knowledge about the assassinations, then from someone claiming to be the author of the Pelican Brief. Intrigued but cautious, Grantham agrees to verify her information before publishing. Meeting at New York's St. Moritz Hotel, Grantham is struck by Darby's youth and transformed appearance. She shares her complete theory, mentioning two Washington law firms involved, White and Blazevich, a very old, powerful, rich Republican firm with 400 lawyers, and Brim, Stearns, and somebody. This information electrifies Grantham, who connects it to Garcia, a frightened lawyer who nearly shared crucial information about the assassinations. Together, they launch an investigation to find Garcia and prove Darby's theory before Matisse's killers find them. Their partnership becomes their strength. Gray brings journalistic resources and experience. Darby contributes legal expertise and firsthand knowledge of the conspiracy. Both recognize the stakes, not just their lives, but the integrity of American justice itself. After interviewing former White and Blazevich summer clerks, Darby and Gray identify Garcia as Curtis D. Morgan, an attorney who called Grantham three times before his death in an apparent mugging. Morgan's widow reveals that before dying, Curtis purchased $1 million life insurance policy and secretly rented a bank lockbox. Inside, they find a videotaped confession detailing Morgan's discovery. A memo from partner M. Velmano to Sims Wakefield stating, "Research is complete, and the bench will sit much softer if Rosenberg is retired." The second retirement is a bit unusual. Einstein found a link to Jensen. Morgan explains that after copying the memo, Wakefield confronted him angrily. Later, finding evidence his office had been searched, Morgan became convinced Matisse orchestrated the killings and feared for his life, fears that proved accurate. This evidence completes the puzzle. Morgan's conscience provided the smoking gun connecting Matisse, the law firm, and the assassinations. With Morgan's evidence secured, Gray and Darby work through the night at the Washington Post to craft their explosive story. Darby notices dark sedans circling the building. Matisse's network remains vigilant. When Gray calls for comments, the conspiracy's reach becomes clear. FBI Director Voiles arrives personally at the Post, breaking protocol. Fletcher Cole confirms Matisse's $4.2 million campaign contribution, but denies White House interference, though his responses betray concern. Marty Velmano at White and Blazevich provides the most telling response. When confronted with Morgan's memo details, his arrogance crumbles. "You don't mind ruining people, do you? You son of a bitch." An inadvertent admission of guilt. Voiles confirms receipt of the brief and its transmission to the White House. Off the record, he reveals recordings captured the president requesting a slowdown of the investigation. As phones ring throughout the Post, with other news organizations scrambling to catch up, Darby and Gray realize they've exposed a conspiracy reaching from Louisiana oil fields to the Oval Office. The fallout is swift. Cole resigns to take the blame. Velmano, Schwab, and Einstein are indicted, though Velmano disappears. Matisse and associates face charges. At White and Blazevich, Sims Wakefield commits suicide, viewing his life insurance as his final act. Exhausted, Darby negotiates with Voiles for safe passage. After several flights to lose potential followers, she reaches a beach house at Maho Bay on St. John. 8 days later, Gray arrives for a warm reunion. Walking along the beach, he updates her on developments. They agree he'll stay for a month. "Let's take it a month at a time," Darby suggests, a tentative new beginning. This story reminds us how fragile our institutions can be. Neither Darby, a curious law student, nor Morgan, a troubled corporate lawyer, sought heroism, yet both chose truth over safety. Their choices show that justice requires ordinary people willing to stand for truth regardless of cost, offering hope that individual conscience can triumph over corruption.